Testing 1, 2. Janice or Giannis, since you are in the Zoom chat, could you tell me if you can hear me over the stream? Just checking. Testing. I'm assuming that we can. Okay. Switch to the slides. Right. So in class today, there's only one person. So I'm hoping a couple more people come. Maybe we'll just give it a couple more minutes before I get going with this. I think I see some people coming in. Morning. Right. Well, I think two people here is good enough to get started, so we can go ahead and go through with that. So yes, welcome to the Data Science for Security and Forensics tutorial 4. And basically the topic of today is, here we are, is pre-processing and feature selection. So pre-processing, the idea being that we're getting the data ready to be used, preparing it in different ways, and say making sure that we have the right type of features to be used and that we've rescaled them in the appropriate ways. And then there's feature selection, where we're limiting the choice of features that we're including, say, for our supervised learning tasks, such that we can have improved accuracy or improved performance. Typically, it's with regards to performance, though. Morning. So before I actually want to get started with this, what I wanted to do quickly is I got a question asking about when you should start the assignments, and the answer to that is as soon as you can. And furthermore, they were asking when is it possible to actually do the assignments. So this is actually from the course syllabus, which I've uploaded to Blackboard, you can find. But here's just the general idea. So you should be able to complete assignment 1 now. That was to be done, or that could be finished after lecture in tutorial 2, because you're just talking about basics of features and classification, and also classification and evaluation, classification and evaluation metrics and classification models. So it's a more general assignment. Assignment number 2 should be totally possible to do after today. So in tutorial 3, we were talking about function optimization, which is the first half of the assignment. So I went through these examples of the genetic algorithm and gradient descent, which is part of the task in assignment 2. And then today we're going to be talking about aspects regarding features and feature scaling. So you should be able to do assignment 2 after this tutorial. Actually, I'm going to jump to assignment 4 for the moment. You should be able to finish it. You should be able to finish the second part after this tutorial, because it deals with feature selection. The first part of assignment 4 is applying a classification method called support vector machines. So that'll be covered either. I think that's going to be covered in week 6, and then assignment 3. That should be doable after lecture and tutorial 6 and 7. So this covers clustering and artificial neural networks. So just that administrative item out of way, we can continue on with the actual tutorial. Okay, so why might we need to pre-process our data? Like, why do we even care about pre-processing? Cleaning. So what do you mean by cleaning?
Unwanted data.
Unwanted data. This is one.
Relevant
data, sure. Any other reason you might want to do some pre-processing?
Sorry?
Any other reason you might want to do some pre-processing? But so far, this is very good. So here are some other reasons you might be interested in doing some pre-processing. Sometimes you need to convert your data into its appropriate type for your given problem. So a common issue is you might have categorical features in your data set, and basically you may be using a classifier that only takes numerical features. So essentially you have to do a pre-processing task which takes your categorical features and essentially turns them into a kind of numerical feature. And you might even do vice versa. So sometimes you have numerical features and you need to turn it into, say, nominal or ordinal features, these categorical kind of features. So it depends on which task you need to accomplish, of course, and the requirements of the algorithm. But sometimes you have to change the data type. And we'll go over some examples of that in a little bit. Furthermore, you may need to extract, say, usable features from the data. So you can't just take, say, a text document and shove it into, say, a neural network. You have to essentially turn it into some sort of numerical vector beforehand. So we've seen examples with turning text documents into this bag of word vectors. And likewise, same thing with, like, images. You can't just shove an image, say, into a neural network. You have to give it, say, like a numerical matrix. So something that's common is you may have the grayscale value, pixel values of a image, which can be used as a vector to be input into, say, a machine learning algorithm. And then if you have a colored image, you may have some, it's technically a tensor, which is a multidimensional matrix of these RGB values. Furthermore, you may need to scale features to a common scale. So some, say, classification methods and other kinds of methods, they're very much affected by the scale, differences of scale in your features, because sometimes they're based on distance metrics. And we're going to see an example later of how, say, if you have multiple features of your data set and one is, say, many magnitudes larger than the other one, the features, then those features essentially overly dictate the performance of this algorithm. And ideally, you'd like to have, say, you'd like to have the different features have an equal effect when you're running these kinds of algorithms. So again, we'll see an example of this later. And then lastly, but not leastly, you may need to handle missing values, say, from samples or features. So sometimes you get a data set, say, you hand out a survey to a bunch of people, you say, how was the feedback on these different aspects on a scale from 1 to 5? Sometimes people don't answer all of the elements of a survey, or maybe the data collection that was done differently in two different, say, collections. And so when you look at your data set, not all your samples may have features present. And of course, if you don't have a, essentially this is like a missing value for a vector, we need to figure out how to, say, fill that value such that you can actually use these features and samples in different machine learning algorithms. Any quick questions regarding why we are interested in data preprocessing? Again, we're going to go over some more examples later, so maybe some more things will be a little more clear then. I'm just going to check the chat real quick. Right, so you should just be able to hear me on for listening. We're not kind of duplicating the audio on Zoom as well. Okay, so how might we transform a categorical feature into a numerical feature? Have you seen any methods to do this in the book or otherwise? Well, I'll tell you how. Of course, there's a number of ways to essentially discretize continuous data, or excuse me, we want to go to categorical to numerical, so we're not talking about discretization yet. So going from categorical to numerical, a very common method to do this is to use something called one-hot encoding. And essentially, this is how it works. So let us have the following samples, and say we have two features for these samples. We have department, where the values can take on information security, computer science, and administration. And then the second feature is sex. So then we have the different possible values of male and female. So clearly these are not numerical features, right? So in order to change them into numerical features, actually technically binary features, which are also numerical, 0 or 1, what we do is essentially we take all of the possible values that these categorical features can take, and we turn each of them into their own binary feature. So, for instance, rather than just having the features of department and sex, now we have the features of is this person in the information security department or not, 0 or 1? Is this person in the computer science department, 0 or 1? Is this person in the administration department, 0 or 1? Is this person male or female, 0 or 1? Is this person female, 0 or 1? Right? So before we had these samples here. These three samples where a person is of the information security department and they're male. But now, when we use one-hot encoding on these two categorical features, we can transform their features for the sample into 10010. This just means, yes, they're information. Yes, they are information security. They're not computer science. They're not administration. They are male, and they are not female. Yeah? And likewise, just as a quick example, for sample 2, we have somebody who's computer science and female. Looking at the binarized features, we see that they are not information security, they are computer science, they're not administration, they're not male, and they are female. So do we see how this works? Yeah? So this is a very, very common method to change categorical features into some kind of numerical features. Any questions? While on the go, could you be a little more specific? I would say the way it works is usually you have, say, your entire training data set, and then for each feature, each categorical feature, you kind of binarize it in this kind of way, where you're limited to the selection of possible values that that feature can take. So in this case, male or female. So if there's a third sex, say just sex Z or whatever, that wasn't present in your initial training data sets, then you wouldn't get these additional kind of binarized features. I mean, if you included more samples in your data set with more features, then you can update it in that fashion, I suppose. But you're kind of limited to the values of the features you have given your current training data set. And then the thing, too, is that, like, well, no, I mean, so what you could do, it would be a bit strange. Usually you want to do this in all one go. So in this case, say you do one hot encoding on these features, but then you wouldn't want to add, say, additional samples that are not using these binary features and using these original categorical features. Typically speaking, you'd like to do it in the first pre-processing run. Just checking the Zoom. Okay. Right. Okay. So we talked about going from categorical to continuous. How might we go to continuous features into discrete or categorical features? So we're going the other way. Now, I know there's an example of this in the book. So how might we go about doing this? Well, there are a number of methods to discretize continuous variables or to make them categorical. But a common and easy method for doing this is to use binning. And you may have seen this when you actually, say, apply histograms. So essentially, you're transforming continuous variables into discrete variables. So these either integers or categorical variables. And essentially, the whole idea is that values falling within some predefined range are mapped to a discrete variable. So as an example, say we have these following ages as continuous values, 12, 30, 26, 40, 54, 70. We can essentially turn these into categorical variables by essentially binning them into certain intervals. Yeah. So everybody from, or say, all feature values from the ages of 0 to 25, we call them a youth. Everybody from 26 to 35 is a young professional. Everybody from 36 to 55 is a professional. And everybody 56 and over is experienced and retired. So now, we can see that we have one feature value falling into the youth category, two feature values falling into the young professional category, feature values falling into the young professional category, but also two features falling into the professional category, and one feature falling into the experienced category. And just kind of further belaboring the point, so say on the left side we have some selection of ages all the way from 7.81. It's not a typical way of recording ages, but we're using continuous variables here, so bear with me, all the way to above 80. And one binning example on the left, on the top here, is we're saying, okay, we have everybody who is above 67 and everybody who is below 67. And then you can do even finer, say, intervals. So now you're having, say, intervals of much smaller values. So everybody who's between 7 and 15, or 15 and 23, 23 and 31, etc. So the selection of the number of bins and their intervals is kind of dependent upon the problem. Kind of a quick and dirty way of doing it is, say, making these separations on the quartiles of the data, so every fourth of the data. And then, like the book, you can also do these kind of more exhaustive approaches where you're kind of, say, searching for the best possible binning, especially with respect to when you're applying this to, say, optimal feature selection. So there's the top-down approach where essentially everything starts in one large bin, and then you divide that bin in half, you split it, you divide each of these bins in half again, you split it again. But then there's the bottom-up approach where essentially everything starts in their own bin, say every one of these values starts in their own bin. You start merging the intervals, say, based on some sort of nearness between the intervals, for instance. So that is one way of doing discretization, going from continuous variables to, say, categorical variables. Yeah? Any quick questions? Okay. On to the next one, then. Why might we want to rescale? In particular, there are a couple of methods of doing this. Let's say there's more than two, but the popular ones are standardization and normalization. Why might we want to rescale our features? So I spoke about this a little bit earlier, but I think I'm just going to explicitly go over it here. So some algorithms are reliant on a distance metrics, so whether or not you're doing supervised learning or unsupervised learning. So features that have, say, much larger magnitudes than smaller features are going to be overly influential of how these algorithms essentially work. So, for example, you may have, as features for a particular sample, the number of bytes in a file versus how many times it's been edited, for instance. So the number of bytes is going to be much, much larger than the number of times that a file has been edited, right? So some examples that are affected by the scale of features that are reliant on these distance metrics are k-nearest neighbors for classification and k-means for clustering. And so I've drawn something here to show you the idea here. So on the bottom left side, what you can see is we have a feature here which can take on the values between 0 and 10,000. And we have a feature here which only takes on the values between 0 and 1. Yeah? And what we've done here is, if you can see it, there's the dots are quite small. But say the number of samples in our training data sets are these little dots. And then we have some unclassified samples that are in the circles. And are you familiar with how k-nearest neighbors works as an algorithm? So this is a classification algorithm where essentially for whatever unlabeled sample you have, what it does is it says, okay, this sample is going to be the class of its k-nearest neighbors. So say you let k be, I don't know, 5. So the 5 surrounding training samples from this unknown sample will dictate by majority vote what the class of the sample is, right? So in the case on the bottom left here, we can see that, okay, there's not much difference in distance, at least relatively, for the Y feature. But what dictates essentially the classification here is going to be the X feature. So the, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 nearest samples with respect to the X feature essentially dictate what the classification of the sample is going to be. Yeah? Now, if you rescale all of the features here between the values of 0 and 1, now your data essentially looks like this. So what you can see here is that now there's, say, an equal influence between the Y feature and the X feature in choosing, say, the classification of the sample. Right? So now this Y feature, this kind of vertical distance, is more important than just the horizontal distance. You see how that works? Okay, so then just as like as a note when you're applying this in practice, just be sure you scale your testing data, your unseen data, with respect to your training data. So there are methods to scale your training data, and basically you want to make sure that you're using the same scale for your testing data as your training data. Otherwise, you're kind of working with two different scales of your data set. So just be careful of that. Okay, so I'd say that one of the more common methods of feature scaling is to do something called normalization. In particular, what is called min-max normalization. And like we just saw, is essentially what you're doing is you're rescaling all of your features, say, whatever their original scales are, you're turning that scale just between the values of 0 and 1. Now, the downside to this method is that it's greatly affected by outliers, as you can see by the equation of the feature scaling here. So this equation for normalization works in the following way. Say for some feature X, we take the particular value of the feature in X we're looking at, and we subtract the minimum from the feature X from our value as the numerator, and the denominator is the difference between the maximum and the minimum of that particular feature. So I've shown some examples here, and I'm going to just work out it really quickly here. So say we want to scale this feature edits to this 0 to 1 range. And essentially, if we want to rescale this particular value, what we're doing then would be, say, 4 minus the minimum value in edits, which is 0. And this is divided by the maximum value subtracted from the minimum value. So 4 minus 0, right? So that's this particular value rescaled in this 0, 1 range. And maybe a slightly more interesting example would be 3, rescaling this. So this would be 3 minus 0 over 4 minus 0. And that's equal to 0.75. Right? We see how it works. It's decently straightforward, yeah? And doing it with the other features is essentially the same thing. But now you're just changing the maximum and the minimum with respect to whatever feature you're looking at, yeah? So for byte size, the maximum would be 65555, and the minimum would be 1024, yeah? So that's one method of rescaling. There's also another method called standardization. Janice, I'll get you to your questions after I discuss discuss standardization. So rather than changing from a range of 0 and 1, what you're doing is, I need to edit this. You're not changing the distribution technically. But essentially, you're changing the range of your features such that your features, for a particular feature, has a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 1. So this is not much affected by outliers, which is one benefit of this approach. However, it also assumes that the distribution, say, of your features is Gaussian, which is a downside, which is why you might choose something like normalization. So very much like normalization, we have a similar kind of, equation, where, for some feature x, what we're doing is we're taking the value of a particular feature, subtracting the mean, and dividing the standard deviation, and this gives us the rescaled feature. So I'm not going to go too much into the depth of it, but essentially what we do have here in the case of transforming, rescaling this feature value into this, would be something like 4, you know, minus whatever the mean is, which is, I don't know, probably 3.5 or something like this, divided by the standard deviation, which is also probably very small. And as you can see here, for each of the features that we are generating, you can tell that the mean of these features is roughly 0. So that's another approach to rescaling feature values. Any questions about rescaling, normalization, or standardization? So I'm going to jump to Janice's question then, or Janice maybe. When binning, will intervals always be the same? No. So it kind of depends on what your problem is and how big you want the intervals to be. So maybe you are familiar with your problem and take, for instance, this age example. So it's not a very useful discretization to have, okay, everybody who is over 67 and everybody who is under 67. It may be much more useful to have, say, something that is with respect to, like, actual reality of how a number of people might see a particular groupings of age. So here, for example, a large majority of the population might agree that, okay, people who are between 0 and 25, they're youths. People between 26 and 35, young professionals. Between 36 and 55 are professionals, and above 56 are experienced or retired. It depends on your problem, the intervals of the bins. And this is even without going into this relationship of discretization of these variables for the purpose of feature selection, which I'm not going to go into too much. In that case, there are optimal intervals such that you maximize the quality of your features. But that's all I'm going to go into it at the moment. We'll talk about feature selection in a little bit. That's good for now. Yeah, no problem. Okay. Then, okay, what can we do if we're missing, if a sample is missing any features? So how do we fill this gap in our data? What are maybe, so say we're doing, we have like, I don't know, continuous data for these features. What might be some methods to fill these gaps? Based on k-means, like a kind of, so k-means is clustering the data. And if you were to cluster, can you go into a bit more of how you would adjust the features using k-means? Okay, but there is something similar that you might do. So you can actually, this is kind of a more sophisticated approach that's not used that often, but essentially you can turn it into a classification problem. So essentially what you do is for the samples that are missing their particular features, you then are using essentially a classifier on the rest of your data to train a classifier to make a guess as to what those missing features are based on the features of the other samples. So, especially in the case that it, for supervised learning, this would be, the features would be either categorical, or if you're doing regression, then the features can be continuous. But yeah, there's a couple of methods to go about doing this. So, like I said, there are reasons why we have missing entries as features. Sometimes people don't fill out entire surveys. The way that information was gathered between, say, multiple sessions was done inconsistently. The easiest way to handle missing features is just to drop these samples entirely. Just get rid of them. So, of course, the downside there is then you have less data. And I think the only time that you should do this is if these samples are missing many, many features. So it'd be like difficult to actually fill the gaps in these features. Some common methods to go about handling missing features is to replace these features for these samples with the most common value found in that particular feature or attribute. So say if you have some continuous data, you would just take whatever the mean is of that feature over all your samples and just fill that into the missing attribute for those samples that are missing those features, right? Same thing with categorical data, except now you're just filling it with the most frequently found value for the feature. If you're using time series data, you can possibly interpolate what's the missing value of the feature is. So essentially you're using regression to fill the gaps in your data or extrapolate something at the end. So for example, for instance, you have some samples here, and essentially what you're doing is you're applying regression here on your existing samples with all of their existing features to make guesses as to what your missing features might be, or extrapolate beyond the range of your samples. What the values of the features might be. Let's see here. Another method is you might use another feature with a high correlation to the feature that is missing some values to make predictions. So again, say You have feature X and Y for some samples, and you can see that they're highly correlated. And essentially, what you're doing is you would say, okay, since there's a strong correlation between, say, the two samples, the two features of these samples, you can just fill in the missing sample of the feature with the highly correlated value of the other feature. So say this sample here, there's a sample here that's just missing some value of its Y feature, and you say, okay, its Y feature is going to be equivalent to whatever the value of the X feature is. And then, of course, you can use, like I said, supervised learning to make predictions of missing data based on the other features. So any questions on how we might go about filling in these gaps with regards to missing features? Yeah, so Yanis was suggesting you might extrapolate from existing data as a way to make predictions of fill in the gaps of the missing features of the samples. Okay, and in that case, let us keep on going. Are you familiar with this term, the curse of dimensionality, and what it means? Essentially, the idea is, why might it be a bad thing to have too many features, too many dimensions in your data? But before we get to that, why is it important to estimate the quality of your features or attributes? Why do we do this in the first place? Like, why do we do feature selection? You can train the model more accurately if you're getting rid of features that have, say, irrelevant information. Any other reasons why we might be removing the number of features? Too many dimensions, and then these training of these algorithms, especially, is not efficient. That's true. Yeah. Right.
If we take all the dimensionality, it's maybe 95% accurate. If we reduce these few dimensions, it's maybe 90% accurate, but it's super efficient.
Right. So he was saying, basically, we want to make sure that we're using features which are, say, more highly correlated with classes, such that we can remove the features that are not highly correlated with the classes. So, whereas if we use all the features in our classification, we may have an accuracy of 95%, but if we remove these features, say, that are less important, then we only reduce the classification, say, by 5%, but the training is much more efficient. Yeah. Yeah, and this is quite true. Yanis is saying, more dimensions means more complexity. Algorithms become more expensive. Filter out highly correlated features. So yes, also features may be highly correlated with themselves, and this is causes essentially this issue of redundant information. And basically, if we can remove that redundant information, then say remove these redundant features, we can have more efficient training for our algorithms. But let's talk a little bit about this curse of dimensionality. What is this? So also known as Hughes phenomenon. The question being, is that are more dimensions or are more attributes and features for your samples always a good thing? And Hughes essentially found that there is such a thing as an optimal number of dimensions for your classification problems if the number of samples you have for your training data is fixed. So let's look at it this way. The more features that we add to our data set, the more sparse the data set becomes when you increase this dimensionality. So sparse data sets allow for easier class separation. As you can see, there becomes much more ways that you can divide the data set, say, hopefully between the different classes. But there's kind of a downside. So at the same time, a high number of dimensions also leads to overfitting. So this ultimately leads to reduced accuracy for unseen samples, right? So if you, say, train and test on a high dimensional data set and your data set is very small, then maybe you have a good classifier for your given data set, but maybe it doesn't perform so well generally. So it is easier to split with more dimensions, but essentially to account for this kind of ease of splitting and finding, these particular exceptions that are kind of being found when you're splitting in high dimensions, this also requires exponentially more training samples to ensure good generalization. So here is a graph kind of just showing classifier performance against dimensionality. And so for any given problem, there's going to be some number, optimal number of features where the performance is best. And then everything, adding more features after that point, you can expect poor performance with regards to generalization. So basically, as a bit of a summary, if the number of samples is held constant, increasing the dimensionality of the data set will only increase the classification accuracy up to a certain point. And including dimensions higher than the optimal will decrease classification accuracy just due to overfitting. And this is caused by the increasing sparsity of the data set. So essentially, you're kind of the more dimensions you add, the more empty your data set is becoming. And ideally, you need to fill it with more samples to kind of fill in the gaps, so to speak. Any questions with regards to the curse of dimensionality? Let's see, any other items regarding why we're doing feature selection and estimating the quality of our attributes? I think we covered all of the important items. So additionally, feature selection and assessing the quality of different features helps us avoid the curse of dimensionality as well. But we mentioned all the other items on this list regarding why we do it. Let's see here. Okay. I think we can take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to come back and talk about more explicitly feature selection rather than pre-processing. So see everybody at roughly 10:09. Right. Let's get back to it. Are you familiar with this concept of impurity? And in particular, with respect to feature selection. I think we read about it in the book. Are there particular feature selection algorithms that use this concept or metric of impurity? The answer is yes, there are. So let's go over kind of what impurity is more generally. It's a quantifiable measure of class homogeneity for some subset of examples. So what is it? It's what this means is the set of samples dominated by one or many classes? Is there a equal distribution of classes in the subset, which makes it very impure, or is it dominated by one, which makes that set of samples very, very pure? So some impurity measures are entropy, which is used in information gain for feature selection, and the Gini index, whereas the book refers to it as the prior Gini index. So kind of going a bit more into the meaning of impurity, say we have two classes for some training data sets, and we just want to measure the impurity of the selection of classes for the samples. So if we have a balanced data set, the impurity of our training data set, if we're taking all of them, is going to be at its highest. And this is with regards to entropy. And if you know anything about entropy in information theory, entropy is essentially a measure of uncertainty. Yeah? So say you randomly select from your samples of data, and you are uncertain whether or not you are going to get positive sample or negative sample, right? Whereas if you have, say, a set of samples that is highly dominated by one class, this is going to be much more pure. The entropy is going to be much lower. Yeah? An entropy near zero. There's not that much uncertainty. If you randomly select from this set of data, all these samples, you're pretty certain that you're going to get, say, the positive sample, yeah, for its class. And likewise, then there's all the ranges kind of in between, where, say, you have somewhat dominated by one class versus the other classes, which will have, say, a medium amount of entropy or uncertainty, yeah? Okay. But why do we care about impurity? So in a nutshell, these values can be used for quantitative rankings of our features, which is quite nice as we've seen in Weka. So in Weka, we've done feature selection, and then they'll output these values such as information gain or maybe Gini index that says, okay, this feature has the highest value here, followed by this feature, followed by this feature, followed by this feature. So just kind of getting a better idea of kind of what impurity is in the context of feature selection is that different values of features can be used to create subsets of samples, where each subset is composed of some sampling of the classes. So for example, say you divide your training set of samples based on if the sample has the feature of feature value of X being greater than or equal to 10. So you have some feature X, and you kind of split on this data set on X equals 10, and everything above 10 is going to be one subset of samples, and everything below 10 is going to be another subset of samples. And basically what you'd be doing for these impurity measures, kind of at the roots of this kind of methodology, is you assess, okay, what is the impurity on this side of the split of this subset of samples, and what is the impurity on this side of the split on this subset of samples? So ideally, for continuous features, you find this threshold value, which optimizes the, say, it's actually minimizes the impurity on either side of the split. So basically, then you essentially get a weighted average of the impurity for each of your features. And this will give you a quantitative metric of how good that feature is. And then you can use these metrics to then order the features using these values. And we'll see a bit of an example of this later using the Gini index. So I know it sounds a bit confusing right now, but it's not as crazy as it sounds. Any initial questions regarding impurity? Okay. Let's see here. Just checking the chat. Okay. What are some common feature selection metrics for classification? Are we familiar with any particular kind of more general methods or particular metrics that are used to rank features? Do we know any of these? What about starting with respect to feature selection, the difference between filter methods and wrapper methods? Are we familiar with these concepts? Let's jump right into it then, huh? Right. So wrapper methods for feature selection, basically you take some subset of features and use that to train a classifier. The best results for classification indicate the best feature subset. So you can train a classifier with any number of subsets of your given features, and ideally you kind of search the space looking for the subset of features that leads to, say, the best or most efficient classification. Right? So what are some downsides of using a wrapper method? It's a bit time-intensive, isn't it? You're having to, say, train a classifier over and over again just to evaluate which features are supposedly performing better or worse, right? Then there are the filter methods, which uses these statistical or information theoretic metrics to evaluate features before a model is trained. So these are, typically speaking, much, much faster than the wrapper methods, yeah? And then you have the embedded kind of methods, which is a combination of the wrapper and filter methods. So kind of going into the different menagerie of different sort of filter methods, we have a couple of the items that we've already mentioned, information gain and the Gini index. And I'm not going to go into depth of how these particular metrics work or methods work right now. Just kind of give you the motivation of what they're doing and why they work. So for information gain, basically, if we're considering a specific feature X, when classifying a sample, we may have more information about which class the sample belongs to than choosing a class randomly. So this basically is saying that if we, say we know what the values of feature X are, the values of these features may be indicative of which class that sample belongs to, right? Essentially, more or less, there's a higher correlation between this value of the feature going to this particular class. And we're actually going to go over an example of this more explicitly later. So higher scores means that this feature is more relevant. Then there's the Gini index method, and I'm talking about the case when we're considering continuous features. And this is kind of going back to this discussion of impurity and applying it to feature selection. So essentially the way it works is you search for this optimal split threshold of a feature such that the classes on either side of the threshold are more homogeneous. Say they have more purity and less impurity. And so basically the feature with the best split, the highest purity on either side of the split, this is considered the best feature. So in this case for the Gini index, the lower score means that that feature is more relevant. So I have a bit of an example here. Show how this works. So say we have just feature X and Y, yeah? And sorry for the bad drawing and writing, but essentially, if we want to do feature selection using the Gini index, what we're doing is we would make a number of splits, threshold splits on this data set, and evaluate the impurity on either side and say, okay, is this feature good or bad? And you do this for each of the features. So let's start with splitting on the values of Y. So for instance, we could try to split here, roughly speaking. And above the split, we have three classes of class. I'm using X's and O's, sorry for the redundant labeling. We have three classes of X and one class of O. And on the other side, we have two classes of O and one class of X. So on either side of the split, we can say that it's not that pure of a split, right? We have a mix of the classes on either side of the split. So, all right, that's not that great. And then you could test the other possible split, which might be something like this, where maybe we now have three X's on one side, two O's on the other side. It's not that pure. It's quite impure. And then on the bottom side, we have one X and one O. So very, very impure. So the optimal place to split on Y is probably this first one. But let's see X, if we can find any splits that lead to kind of better overall purity for the splits. So, I mean, just looking at this data set here, where might be the best position to split the data set to get kind of the most pure class subsets on either side of the split? Exactly, right? So here, we would say, okay, actually, on the right side of the split, we have total purity. There's no mixture of the classes. On the left side of the split, we have nearly total purity with respect to samples of class X. And then overall, we can say, okay, the feature X has this particular split, which has say high impurity on either side or high purity on either side, which indicates that say this feature is better than this feature. The say Gini index or the impurities based on the splits for Y are say not so good, whereas we found a very good one with respect to X. So that is more or less how the Gini index works. And this is actually how kind of the process of creating decision trees works as well, which is an item that we'll go over, I think, the next tutorial, not this one. Okay, so we went over the impurity kind of based filter methods. Let's briefly discuss some of the statistical based methods. A very nice one is called correlation feature selection, and you can find it in Weka. And essentially, what it does is it calculates the correlation of a subset of features S and, say, some classes C. So, A, we're identifying which features are highly correlated with the classes, but also it takes into account that better scores occur when features for your subset are weakly correlated. So features are highly correlated with the classes, but not so correlated with each other. That's a sign of redundant information, right? Then there's the use of the Pearson correlation coefficient, and I've seen it been used in kind of the two different possible ways. Again, calculating a correlation between some feature F and some class C, but also we can use it to calculate correlations between, say, two different features, F and G, to identify redundant features. And this is something that we've seen before. Yeah? There's then also the chi-squared test. So these are tests that basically test if a feature is independent of a class label. It's quite similar to the other kind of statistical methods, where a higher score indicates that the feature is more important. Any initial questions regarding some of the different methods of feature selection? It's kind of a quick overview to give some motivation of how the different methods work. Okay. So before we get into kind of the applied examples, do we know what principal component analysis is or why it's used? So we went over it in the last lecture. Kind of what is its main purpose? So I have a bunch of text here, but basically the main purpose is that it's a method to, maybe somebody spoke on, no, never mind. It's a method to extract some features from your existing data set based on the variance of your features. But the whole idea is that the features you extract are very potent and information dense. And that the, say, principal components that you extract are much, much more information dense than, say, the other possible features that you can extract. So quite typically, you have, say, I don't know, say you have a start of 5 features in your initial data set, and you apply principal component analysis to this data set, and you extract these new features, and you can easily kind of reduce the dimensionality from your initial 5-dimensional data set down to, say, a 2-dimensional data set that you can also visualize. So let's see here. Any items that I missed? Additionally, the features that you're extracting, they're totally uncorrelated. So that means that each of the features you are making have no redundant information between each other, which is also a really nice property of principal component analysis. Right, and so it's commonly used to visualize high-dimensional data in, say, a 2-dimensional or 3-dimensional space. It's a pretty common use case of it. But let's go over kind of more explicitly how it works, yeah? So we're going to go over a simple example first where we have, and this is really not the best choice of features here. I've chosen, just forget about it says inches and centimeters, just say feature X1 and feature X2. So going from 2 dimensions to 1 dimensions using principal component analysis, how does it work? Well, the first thing we do is we identify the principal component of this data. And what this is essentially it's a vector on your data that points in the direction of your data with the most variance, the most amount of spread. Yeah? So we can see here in this data that this direction clearly has the most amount of spread. Right? And we get 2 values when we do this, what is called eigen decomposition of the covariance matrix. We get the eigenvector, which represents the magnitude of the spread, and we get the, the direction of the spread. The eigenvalue is the magnitude of the spread. So how much variance is in that particular direction? Let's see here. Right, so that's the first step. So and this is the principal component. The subsequent principal components are all orthogonal to the first and each other. Now, orthogonal just means, say, at a 90-degree angle in any kind of multi-dimensional space. This kind of what guarantees the futures are uncorrelated with each other. So here's our principal component here, and then the, say, next principal component being orthogonal to the first principal component points in this direction, and as we can see, its eigenvalue, its magnitude is much less than the first principal component. Okay, so why are we kind of generating these vectors and these eigenvalues and whatever? Well, essentially, the original data that we have, we can now project it onto these new axes that are kind of defined by our eigenvectors, our principal components. So we can see here, we've now mapped our data onto our principal components, with the largest principal component pointing in this direction, the smaller one pointing in this direction. And the way that the dimensionality reduction is done is essentially just by using less components than our original features. And the components that you choose to not include are the ones that have low eigenvalues, that have low amount of variance. And the way that you can think about it is that essentially the components that capture the most variance are the features that are capturing the most amount of information from the original data set. So our new features should capture the majority of variance and information of the original data set, now with less dimensions. And so we can see we've gone from two dimensions here, where we can just, say, use a single dimension, where we can ignore the second principal component that doesn't have that much information. So this is an example of reducing from a three-dimensional space to a two-dimensional space using principal component analysis. We can see that the principal component for this data set, the area with the most amount of spread, it's difficult to say, but it's likely in this direction, the second principal component being in this direction, where we can see that the third orthogonal direction is going to have a very small eigenvalue because there's not much variance in that direction. And essentially what we're doing is we're mapping our original data sets onto the components with the most spread. So we're going from three dimensions to two dimensions in this case. And you can go from, say, any number of dimensions from your original data set down to some small amount of dimensions that you can actually visualize. So, any questions with regards to principal component analysis and how it works? We'll also be doing a quick example of it later that kind of shows more of the mathematical side. But this is the, say, motivational side. Does it make sense? You're essentially mapping your original data sets onto these new vectors that are based on, say, the directions of spread of your data. Yeah? Okay. Now onto some practical examples. What we're doing here is we want to measure the class impurity of the following data, and we want to use the entropy and Gini index and classification error. This is from the book. So essentially what we're doing is we're just looking at all of our samples here and saying, okay, what is the class impurity of our data set? And then afterwards, we're going to try to select the best feature using information gain and the Gini index. Let's see here. So this is just clarifying what impurity is. So there's different, here are the equations for the different impurity measures that we're going to be using. So entropy, and this is log base 2. The Gini index in the classification error. And then PJ is just what is the probability of choosing a sample of this particular class. That's all that notation means. So when you're calculating the entropy of all the samples, we can see that we have four samples of class 1, two classes of class 2, and two classes of class 3, right? We go back here, see, 4 of class 1, 2 of class 2, 2 of class 3, right? Simple enough. And if we wish to calculate the entropy or the impurity of essentially the classes for our samples, we just plug in these values into the probabilities for this equation here. So this is just saying, okay, take the negative value of the following sum, which is just the probability of class 1 log the probability of class 1 plus the probability of class 2 log the probability of class 2, so on and so forth. So clearly we can see that, okay, the probability of class 1 is going to be 4 over 8. That gets us a half. We just plug in the values here. You can see that the probability of class 2, which you've already calculated, is 2 over 8. And likewise, the probability of class 3 is also 2 over 8. Yeah? So then we can just plug in the values here to get our total amount of uncertainty for this particular set of samples. That the class purity is not so pure, essentially. So a purely homogeneous set would have an entropy of 0. So that's just an example of applying entropy. Gini index is a little bit easier to calculate. So using the same probabilities as before, now all we're doing is we're just taking the square of each of the probabilities of the different classes and summing them up and subtracting it from 1. And we end up with a Gini index of the following value. And just as a reminder, a purely homogeneous set has a Gini index of 0. And then we can do the same with calculating this this impurity of the samples with regards to the classification error, which I think I'm going to skip for now. You can look at it at home. But okay, so we've done this kind of calculations on the impurity of the different samples, but now let's start to think about how we can actually use something like information or the Gini index to generate these feature quality measures or attribute quality measures for the purpose of feature selection. Yeah? And in particular, we're focusing on information gain and the Gini index. So, we're going to do an example by hand here. So, how about ranking these attributes in a quantitative way using the information gain? So, the information gain requires two things. It requires the class entropy, which we've already calculated, and also requires this conditional entropy of essentially what is the entropy of our samples for the class, given that we have some information about the value of the samples of feature X, for instance. And recall, the whole point of information gain is to say, okay, if we know what the values of this feature is, this feature might be, say, more highly correlated with particular classes. So knowing the values of this feature gives us more information about potentially these samples classes, at least much more than selecting these samples randomly. Yeah? So this is a bit of a spoiler for the ending results, but let's see how we actually go about calculating information gain to estimate the quality of at least feature X. We're not going to go over all the features, just for feature X. So let's write down oops, information gain for that we get when looking at feature X is equal to the entropy for the classes minus the conditional entropy of the classes given feature X. And this is what we're trying to calculate. What is this value? Now, recall we already calculated the entropy of the classes, kind of just the uncertainty of choosing samples at random. And we need to calculate the conditional entropy. So this is the entropy of class C given feature X, which has the following equation. And I'm just taking these equations and these definitions from the book. So first thing we have here is the sum of this particular probability Pj, where we are defining this as the possible discretized values of feature X. So this is going over all the different probabilities that feature X can take its particular values. And this this probability is multiplies by the following sum, where K is representing the different possible classes. And the equation here is a little bit more complicated, but we're going to go into the details of what each of these probabilities mean. But essentially, what this is the probability of choosing a sample of class K given feature value J. This is essentially what that says. So let's break it down a little bit. So the probability of selecting a sample of class K given feature value J is equivalent to the following probability, which is a bit annoying, but it's required to actually calculate this probability. This is the joint probability of choosing a sample with class K and feature value J. This is divided by the probability that this feature has the feature value of, say, J. I know it's getting a little complicated now. So let's see here. We have to define exactly what this joint probability is as well. And this here is essentially just the count of samples that are of this particular class K and have the feature value of J divided by the total number of samples. So I'll write this down as well. So N is total number of samples, and N CK BJ is number of samples of class CK and has an X value of VJ. And just writing down the final probability, the probability of a sample takes on a that's a sample's X feature takes on a particular value. Just explicitly written out like this. So this notation just means that the number of samples of this feature that take on the value VJ So now we have all the components necessary in order to actually calculate this conditional entropy. And it seems a little bit complicated at first, but once you break it down, it's not too bad. So feature, and we're only considering feature X. And what we need to do is we need to say, okay, first we're going to look at these expressions focusing on when feature X takes on the value of 0, right? So in this case, we say, okay, the probability that feature X is going to be 0, recall this is the equation that we're going to be calculating this value from. And I've written down our data here. So given our number of samples here, how many of the samples have a feature value of X equal to 0? 4, right? And in total, there's 8 samples. Therefore, we can say, okay, this probability is equal to 0.5. Yeah? Okay, that's the first component. So we've kind of taken care of this part. Now we need to take care of this part, which looks quite complicated at first, but we can kind of break it down in a more simple way. So we're going to be taking half times this sum, which I'm kind of setting up here, where we're going to have the summation of these logs, right? And so we need to say, okay, how do we break this down? This joint probability of choosing a sample of class K given the feature value J. We look over here, and notes that the denominator on each of these probabilities is a value we already calculated. This is the probability of a sample having a feature value X of 0. So we already know this. So that means we can put half on all of our denominators. And I should quickly mention here, each of these kind of log considerations here are considering when it is, we're looking at samples of, say, class 1, class 2, and class 3. Yeah? Okay, so now we just need to figure out what the numerator of this is, at least when we're looking at samples of class 1 and have a feature value of X being equal to 0. So the numerator here is saying, okay, count up the number of samples that are of class 1 and X equals 0 divided by the total number of samples. Okay, so let's do that. Looking at our data sets, how many samples are of class 1 and have a feature value of 0? Right, so there's 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 such samples, exactly. So this is going to be 4 over 8. 4 over 8. And rather than actually calculating this right now, let's just continue on looking at the other considerations when looking at the other classes. So we're just filling out the denominators here because they're all going to be the same. And again, what we're doing is we're looking at this value here, the number of samples of class 2, given that the feature X is equal to 0. So how many samples are there that have the categorization of class 2, but feature X is equal to 0? None, exactly. So that's going to be 0 over 8, 0 over 8. And let's quickly do the consideration for class 3. How many samples are there that are of class 3 and have a feature value X of 0? again, it's none of them. Right. So we have 0 over 8, 0 over 8. And we can quickly calculate these logs here because they're just multiplied by 0 in the front. And this will be log, let's see here, of 1, which is actually just equal to 0. So the first summation, it all adds up to 0. And the way you can look at it is, essentially, we're looking at this subset of samples here, and when looking at the subset of samples here, it has very high purity. Essentially, there's a high correlation between feature value of x of being 0 and class 1. That's a high purity. Okay, now let us look at when x's value is equal to 1. So for our given data set, this is the only other value that x can take on, right? And we're essentially just repeating the same process now, but rather than considering when x is equal to 0, we're considering when x is equal to 1. So again, we're going to calculate what is the probability of that a sample has an x value of 1. Looking at the data set here, how many samples have an x value of 1? Exactly, 4 of them. So 4 out of 8, again, this is half. And essentially what this is doing when we multiply it in the front, this essentially weighs, gives a weight to each of the kind of subsets that we're calculating the impurity on. So again, we're multiplying this by the following portion of the equation, where we're considering the occurrence of these samples, given that feature X has this value and takes on these different classes, right? So just kind of quickly writing out the necessary items for the summation here. And looking at the equation, again, we're calculating this conditional probability, which we can look here, which is this joint probability over this probability we already know. So let's just fill in the bottom part of each of the logs. That's just half, something we already calculated. All right, so now we need to actually calculate the numerator on each of these values. So this joint probability. So this first one being here is, what are the number of samples of class 1 where x is equal to 1? So 0, exactly. So we have 0 over 8, 0 over 8. Now I promise it's going to get slightly more interesting now. This instance here, where we have, we're considering the number of samples where it takes on class 2 with a feature x value of 1. So how many samples have an x value of 1 but is of class 2? 2, right? 1, 2. So that's 2 over 8. And now just doing the same thing for class 3. Exactly. So we see here there are 2 samples of class 3 that have an x value of 1. All right, so we're almost done here. Now this here evaluates to 0, and here it gets to a little bit more complicated of some log expressions. So this is going to be half times log half plus negative half times log, excuse me, not negative, get rid of that for now, log half. And just some simple kind of logarithmic kind of substitution in arithmetic, we can get the following values. So half log 2, where we essentially put a minus out the front to get rid of the inverse inside the log, minus half log 2. And log 2, when base 2, is just equivalent to 1. So now we're getting this total summation of 1 half times 0 plus negative half is in total equal to negative a half. So when, I'm running out of space here, but I'm going to fit it in. So when considering the total conditional entropy of class of the classes given feature X, we have this negative value that we multiplied by what we calculated here, added up with what we calculated here. So that is 0 minus 0.5 equals 0.5. And then this is kind of the big kicker at the very end here. We're returning to this expression up here, because now we've calculated all the necessary values. So we're getting what is the actual information gain we get by knowing these values of feature X. And ultimately, we get that the information gain of X is equal to 1.5 from the class entropy, where we're kind of choosing at random, minus this conditional entropy, where we're considering feature X. So feature X gets us an information gain of 1 in the end. So now we're done. And I'm not going to go over calculating these same sort of values for the other features, but you can see here, once the screen pops up, that feature X gets you an information gain of 1, feature Y gets you an information gain of 0.5, feature Z gets you an information gain of 0, meaning that we have a sort of ranking to our features of in order of importance or usefulness, right? Any quick questions with regards to information gain? Oh, I'll get to your question, Yanis, after we finish discussing this. Any questions on information gain? I know that the, yes. For information gain, yeah. So he was asking, does a higher value of information gain lead or mean that a feature is more important? And the answer is yes. Any other questions? I'm going to quickly go over similar kind of calculations for the Gini index for calculating feature or attribute quality measures such that we can put an ordering on the values of the attributes. And we're considering the case where we're kind of looking at our features, even though they're 0 and 1 in binary, but we're considering them to be continuous in this case. And the whole idea is that we're going to consider all the splitting points for each feature X on the data set and calculate where the Gini index is least for each feature. So essentially what we're doing is we're going back and doing this, but we're actually going to calculate some numbers. Let's see here. Okay. So in our case, luckily, there's only one place that we can split on each feature because each feature only falls between 0 and 1. So that is what we're doing. And when we split on X at 0.5, let's see here. We are going to be calculating the following equation for the Gini index, which is 1 minus the sum of probabilities of choosing the different classes. So let's see here. If we split on 0.5 for X, going back to our data set here, then we're only going to be considering this subset of samples. And in this subset of samples, we only have 4 samples of class 1 and no samples of the other classes. So essentially what we do here is the probability of choosing a sample of class 1 on the left side of the split is going to just be 1, and we square each of these probabilities. And then the probability of choosing the other classes are just 0. So they go to 0. And then we do a weighted value of each of the sides. So half of the total samples are on the left side, and half of the total samples are on the right side. Okay. So then let's look and see what is on the right side here. The right side of the split. We see that we have 2 samples from class 2 and 2 samples from class 3, but no samples from class 1. So we have the probability of selecting class 1 is 0, probability of selecting class 2 is 1/2, probability of selecting class 3 is also 1/2, where we square these values and do the necessary arithmetic. And we sum up both of these sides to get a total weighted average Gini index of 0.25. Now, kind of the main punchline here is that a lower Gini index is actually better. It indicates that the feature is better and leads to more purity on either side of the split. So I'm not going to go too much more into it because I think I've spoken enough about it. But you can do the same thing where you are, say, splitting on Y and splitting on Z. Let's look at the case where we split feature Z on 1/2 and see what we get. So on the left side of the split, so all the values where feature Z is equal to 0, let's add up how many of each sample is of each class. So we have 2 samples of class 1, and then we have 1 sample of class 2 and 1 sample of class 3. So we are just inputting our probabilities of, say, selecting these samples with respect to the classes on either side of the split. So this is for class 1, class 2, class 3. And we're squaring these values and doing the necessary arithmetic. But as you can see, even on this side of the splits, the amount of classes seems to be quite impure, right? There's a mixture of classes, which ultimately leads to this value here. And then likewise, on the right side of the split, so whenever Z is equal to 1, we have a class ID of... let's see here. We have two samples of class 1, and 1 sample of class 2, and 1 sample of class 3. So it's the exact same sort of equation or expression found on the other side of the split. And we take the total weighted average Gini index of both sides, which leads us to a higher value, which indicates that this feature is of lower quality. And so we can see, looking at all the different Gini index values calculated from the different features, X has the lowest. It's the superior feature. So I know I went through that a bit quick, but I think I did that because we don't have too much time and I discussed enough about information gain. But any quick questions regarding Gini index or the other feature selection methods? Yes.
Why do we need to subtract it from 1? We could just say that the lower value is indicating that the index is...
That's a good point. To be honest, I don't know. There's probably some sort of motivational reason behind it, indicating that lower values equals more purity. But it's a good question. I have no idea. Okay, so before we take another break, I'm going to just quickly answer this question Giannis had regarding principal component analysis. He was asking, what do you do in principal component analysis if the orthogonal vector is about the same magnitude as the eigenvector, the data has almost the same spread in both dimensions? I mean, I would say you're probably going to your principal component, whatever it is going to be the vector or eigenvector with the highest eigenvalue, with the most spread. And if these values are very, very similar, I mean, that means that they both are probably of high quality, so you should keep them both. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and we can be back here at 11:16. Yeah? My projector decided to turn off. Just a second here. All right, let's get back to it. So this is an example of actually kind of the more mathematical side of principal component analysis. And I'm not going to go through every little detail of it, but just walk you through the broad strokes of more or less how it works. So there are some things I kind of skipped over last time because it added to the complexity of it. Just as a quick aside, this is like a code written in Octave, a similar language as MATLAB, that does all of the steps for principal component analysis that you need to do. So you can see it's actually decently straightforward. But more or less, here is how it works. So the first thing that you do, and this is something I skipped over beforehand, is you have your original data set on the left side, but you essentially create a data set with a mean of zero. So a mean adjusted data set, and this is done by subtracting the mean of each attribute from the respective attributes. So all we're doing is, say, we're moving the data from maybe it's in the top right quadrant of your two-dimensional or three-dimensional axes. We're moving it to the center. That's all we're doing. So just as a side note, adding a constant to the data does not change the variance at all. So we still retain that variance information that we need. Then what we do is we calculate the covariance matrix between all the different features. Just this is what helps us choose the direction of the spread. We perform this eigendecomposition on the covariance matrix, which produces these vectors, which will be our essentially our principal components, where then they have their associated eigenvalues, kind of the strength of their variance in that particular direction. So here we see this vector has the highest amount of variance, this vector second highest, followed by this first vector here. And then what we do is we essentially just take the desired number of eigenvectors in order of greatest eigenvalues, their magnitudes, showing the variance in these different directions. And these eigenvectors are the directions of your principal components. So essentially what we're doing is we're taking our highly, say, informational vectors, and we're doing some linear algebra multiplication to essentially transpose our data onto these new axes. So this is essentially a transposition of our mean-centered data onto the most important principal components, and likewise our mean-centered data transposed onto the second most important principal component with less variance in that direction. And then, of course, the Python approach is super simple, as you can see. But the resulting values, kind of these new features that you've extracted from the from this process, are the same that we calculated by hand, as we did with the Python examples. So essentially, what we did is we went from this space here on the left side onto this space here on the right side, where you can see that there's no, at least, identifiable correlation between any of the features. Yeah? So that's just kind of a quick run-through of the more technical side of principal component analysis. Any questions regarding these processes? It makes a little sense? A little sense? Yeah? If it doesn't make sense, just ask. I'm going to skip over the majority of this problem. This is essentially asking that you apply a bunch of different kind of feature evaluation metrics to the IRIS data sets, including using different statistical packages, so like Weka, and then also using RapidMiner, for instance. And I'm not going to go through it explicitly, but the point being, for our different features that we've seen many times before, all of the different feature ranking methods, despite them being different, all agree upon that petal length and petal width are the best features. The only thing of note here is that RapidMiner, for some reason, they report their Gini index weights. They show that higher values indicate better features, which is unusual, but it's what they show. This is something we've seen before, using feature selection with all attributes, say getting an accuracy of 96.66% versus doing classification with just the two best attributes. So we just saw a reduction in accuracy of roughly 1.5%, and the time taken to build the model is also faster, just indicating the purpose and usefulness of feature selection. This one is a bit more interesting, and I think I'll walk through it. So we're going to be using the IRIS dataset again, and we're actually going to extract some principal component analysis features. And then we're going to be using those features for the purpose of classification. So let's go ahead and open up Weka. So I've already imported the IRIS dataset, as you can see here. So things we've seen before, and we can see that they have correlated features, so on and so forth. So let's just go to select attributes and select principal components from this list here. And the only variable that you might need to modify is this variance covered, as this will, for some reason, indicate or essentially control the number of principal components returned to you, number of features extracted to you. So we'll let it choose, just cover this variance chosen here. And if you change that value, you get different principal components even. Okay, so here what we have is we've extracted these four new features where our data has been transposed onto these features here, where they're ranked. And what we can actually do here is you can actually save your transform data and feed it back to Weka. So I'm just going to call this PCA. I'm just making sure I'm not renaming a file. So let's take our newly extracted features. And just to show you something, this is how the features look when comparing them. And you can see that there's really no correlated features anymore of the data set, which is quite interesting. So let's just get rid of this first, I think this is the least useful feature according to the ranking here. So the ranking here shows that the least useful feature or principal component starts with negative 0.801. So let's remove it and do some classification, just using SVM. So using SVM and using these features that have the grand majority of all the variants, we get a classification accuracy of 96.66%. And this is like just as high as the classification accuracy using the original features. Okay, so let's see if we can reduce the dimension even more. So we've gone from 4 dimensions to 3 dimensions. Let's see what happens when we go from 3 dimensions to 2 dimensions. So removing the next feature that covers not so much variance, This is going to be negative 0.721. So, okay, they're put in order of their rank 2, which is convenient. So let's remove that. And in this case, actually, there was a good amount of reduction with respect to the accuracy. So apparently that feature had a good amount of information. But let's also see what happens when we take away the second most important feature as well. So let's try classifying this. And surprisingly, in this case, we get even a better accuracy. So in this case, we've reduced our dimensions from 4 to 1, where we've only had a reduction in accuracy of roughly 5%, which isn't too bad. And of course, it trains much, much faster, given that it's only trained with a single feature. So that's kind of principal component analysis in practice. And then, and I have some old examples here from another experiment I did that you can also verify with yourself. And it's dependent upon this. Your results are going to be dependent upon this value here. So if you choose a lower variance covered, then it returns to you less principal components. And for some reason, that also changes, I think, the direction of the features as well. Okay, so the last thing that we're doing today is just covering a walkthrough using a Google Colab that I set up. And the whole point is to do these feature processing steps that we talked about in class and then finally end with some actual feature evaluation and feature selection. So I don't know if any of you have run through this or are running through it with me while we're talking, but you are welcome to. I need to reconnect here. And I need to redrop my data. So the first thing that you need to do is to there we go. You need to download the data from the source that I've given you, or download it from Blackboard, where I've already uploaded it. And oh man, the internet is so bad here. Let's see if I can plug in an Ethernet cable. Well, I can tell you about the data set while it's being uploaded. Essentially, this data set is a decently high dimensional data set where the whole point is it has, say, some 100,000 samples where it records a bunch of features from airline passenger travelers regarding who they are, what kind of service they're flying, and a bunch of different recordings of how they rank the usefulness or the ease of different aspects of their flight. And the whole point is to do a classification on customer satisfaction. That's the whole thing. So are you satisfied or are you not satisfied? So it looks like it's been uploaded now, so we can actually start running through the code. So again, we're using pandas. This, if you take away anything in this course, just please learn how to use pandas to organize your data. So we read in the CSV file, and we are looking at our data set, and we can notice a couple of things regarding our data set. So for instance, the first two features, how important do you think these features are? It looks like an index here and then a ID for the different customers. Is this indicative of customer satisfaction? It should not be. So these are examples of irrelevant features. They don't help classification in any which way, right? So there's a number of other interesting aspects about this data set. Does anybody want to take a stab at what is difficult or necessary to pre-process regarding this data set? What can you note about the different features we have? So we have some categorical features over here, and we have some numerical features over here, right? So we have a mixture of these feature types, and quite often we need to transform everything into one type. Most times that's converting everything into a numerical type. Yeah. And then there's one more thing about this data set, which is not obvious, but when you look at for each of the features, this is just showing how many of the samples contain these feature values that are not null, not empty. And most of them, all of the features are there. But we actually have some missing features for arrival delay in minutes. We're missing roughly 300 samples are missing this property. So this is another issue regarding this data set. There's one last issue regarding the data set. So look at, for instance, flight distance versus in-flight Wi-Fi service. Is there anything of note between these two different features? One of them is multiple magnitudes larger than the other one. Right? So, depending upon the classification method we use, these features with these large numbers may influence our classifications in a negative way. Okay, so the first thing we should do, let's get rid of those irrelevant features in the front. So one nice thing about these data frames is you can just choose which columns to drop. Those features are gone. So I've just removed these, customer ID and this index type in the front. Okay, that solved the issue of these, at least initially, as we can see, irrelevant features. Let's also try to figure out how to replace the missing data. And you recall there's a couple of ways about doing this. And one such way is I'm generating a correlation matrix between the different features, and the idea was to say, okay, we have, I can't remember which feature was missing. It was either arrival delay in minutes or departure delay in minutes. Either way, these features are very correlated, which means that we can take the features that exist in the correlated feature that are there and just copy and paste them into our missing features, right? Because they should be roughly identical. And it makes sense. If you have a departure delay, then you're probably going to have an arrival delay as well. Yeah? And furthermore, if you look explicitly at these two different features, you can see that they're highly correlated. So I wanted to do this. Due to time and just the trying to replace these missing values and arrival delay with minutes was being very finicky. I opted not to because I could not find the null values. So ideally we would have just done this replacement, but we ended up with doing the more simple one, which is just taking the average delay in minutes and inputting that into all the missing feature values for this particular feature. And again, another reason to use pandas and data frames, they have a function for doing this for you. So it essentially went through my data set and looking through all 300 features or whatever and said, okay, just fill in these features with the average. So we took care of it at least in this way. So we check if the empty entries are still there. And we see, no, they've been filled. So that's another checklist, a little check on our mark of pre-processing. Okay, now we have the issue of features that are categorical, and we need to transform into numerical features. What can we do? We We learned a method to do this. What was that method? Even generally, you don't have to remember the name. Categorize them depending upon their range. That was not what I had in mind. What we can do is essentially take the categorical features, and for every value that these features can take, turn that into a binary feature. This one hot encoding sort of idea. So this is what we're doing. And again, I didn't have time to adjust things as I wanted to, so I was doing some steps that are not entirely necessary. But also, again, pandas and data frames has this functionality where they can take a particular feature and a categorical feature, and it can apply one-hot encoding using this function called getDummies. So I'm applying this one-hot encoding to gender, so that should be male and female, customer type. I can't exactly remember which that was, type of travel, and class. So, for example, looking at going from class, which used to take on the values of business class, and economy plus class, we've now transformed this one feature, categorical feature, into three binary features, right? So we go through all of our different samples, and we have these different binary values for these samples. I mean, they're representing the same thing, but now they're numerical. So, for example, here we're saying this person is flying in economy class and not business class and not economy plus class, right? So let's just make sure that we remove our original categorical features from our data sets and be sure to add our new binary features, which are numerical, to the data set. Yeah? So this is all of our data, well, the head of our data, but all of our features. After turning all of our features numerical, removing the irrelevant features, and filling in the missing data, right? So we can see everything is numerical except for the classification tag, which is okay. Okay, we still need to handle the issue of scaling. But first things first, I'm just putting the classes for each of the samples to the side such that we can apply numerical scaling on the rest of the data set. So I'm just saving essentially these classification targets or labels as its own vector for now, putting it to the side. And we can apply min-max normalization to our data set, where I'm just applying the exact same function I was showing you before in class. And you can apply it across the entire data frame to all of your numerical features. So here, now we can see things like age, and flight distance, and Wi-Fi service, everything else. Everything is falling in between the range of 0 and 1. That can be good. Now, I also initially was planning on running some feature selection methods within Python, but I didn't have time to fully go through it. So essentially what we are going to do, just because it's a bit easier and more interpretable, is that we're going to take our data set that we have pre-processed, and we're going to output it as a CSV file and use that as input into Weka to do the feature selection for us. It's much more interpretable that way as well. So initially I was going to apply chi-squared feature selection here, which it will perform, but it will just output the selected features for you and not necessarily give you the labels of those features, which I thought was a bit annoying. So let's see how it actually works. Let's see here. Up believe it's called Airline Feature Selection. Yeah. So I've already done that. And before we do any sort of classification or anything, basically we want to find out what are the most useful features of this data set. And as you can see, we have a lot of different features. Right? So we just go to the Select Attributes tab. And let's do something like information gain. And we can do cross-validation. That's fine. We select our label for our data sets, satisfaction. And it takes just a couple of seconds to do the cross-validation feature selection. If you do the wrapper methods when trying to find the best features on this data set, it takes a very long time. Because we have 100,000 different samples, and we have 25 or so different features. And I didn't even bother to wait around to see how long it took. Okay, so the information gain ranking is done. And the best features that it has chosen for us, and I'm just going to go over the first five of them, is online boarding being the most important feature for satisfaction. It makes sense. In-flight Wi-Fi service also makes sense. Whether or not they're in business class makes sense. Apparently, whether or not they're traveling for personal travel or business travel is indicative of their satisfaction as well. Yeah? And just for fun, let's run through this correlation feature selection. And I can start to show you some of the results on the actual slides. Let's see here. Whoops, that was the wrong one. While that's calculating. Okay, so on my previous run-through of evaluating these different features, for information gain, I got the same features that were selected. And for the correlation feature selection, I also got online boarding, in-flight Wi-Fi, but I also got check-in service as a more important feature. Arrival delay in minutes. But notice you didn't get departure delay in minutes because correlation feature selection ignores features which are correlated with other important features. And also type of travel, being business travel, as important features. So going back to Weka, we can see, let's see here, this is greedy stepwise. Ah, yeah, and this way it does not rank it in the same ordering as information gain. It just shows you correlation percentages being higher, meaning the feature is more important. So in-flight Wi-Fi service being important, online booking being important, etc. So let's go ahead and just do some tenfold cross-validation using all the features and see what kind of accuracy we get, as well as you can note how long it is taking to train. So I think I'm going to spoil it a little bit. At least beforehand, I got accuracy for satisfaction using all features being roughly 86%. And also spoiling it, just using the features, say, three most important features using these different feature selection metrics. I got using online boarding, business class, and in-flight Wi-Fi, I got a classification accuracy of roughly 84%. So only a loss of accuracy of 2.5%, but the training of the algorithm was nearly 10 times as fast. So let's see if this is done. See, it's still working, as we can see. But you can test it at home to verify that for yourself, to see the speed up as well as not so much loss in accuracy. Here, let's stop this for now and just quickly show you. It should go a little bit faster when we reduce the features to 3. Online boarding, business class, in-flight Wi-Fi. So let's get rid of everything besides those. Let's see, online boarding. Was that one? I'm just getting rid of all these different features here. So online boarding, in-flight Wi-Fi service, and business class. That's the other one I need. Is business class? Yes. So do this. Remove everything but those 3. And let's try this again, see if it runs a little faster. Finishes in a good amount of time. Well, it should. You can, of course, try this at home to verify it for yourselves. I don't want you to just stay there waiting, looking at the Kiwi bird. But, any questions regarding the tutorial? Because this is all I've had for you today. Like I said before, you should be able to finish homeworks 1 and 2 in their entirety now. I hope you guys have a good week. Until next time. Thanks. But no final questions regarding the tutorial, right? We're okay?